This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for August 29th, 2017. On today's show, in the water cooler, I'll be talking about Magic Castle again, because why not? And give first impressions on Marvel's The Defenders. Ben will be talking about seeing La La Land on a rooftop in Los Angeles. In the news, we'll be talking about the early buzz from Stephen King's It, the death of filmmaker Tobe Hooper, casting changes on Hellboy, and how the new Star Wars comic connects Luke Skywalker with Rogue One. And in our feature presentation, Y Tran Bui will talk about her visit to Pixar to learn about their new film, Coco. But with me now is Ben Pearson.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What have you been up to this weekend?
So I went to see La La Land. It's part of the Rooftop Cinema Club here in Los Angeles. I think they have it in London, LA, and New York right now. It's pretty cool. It's at the Montalban Theater on Vine Avenue, right in the sort of the heart of Hollywood, really. And La La Land, they have a bunch of different screenings. They have like The Godfather and all sorts of stuff. It's sort of similar to the
Street food cinema and stuff?
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
but it seems like seeing La La Land on a Los Angeles rooftop is just like perfect.
Yeah, and that's exactly why we chose to do it. I actually had only seen the movie once in theaters, you know, last year when it first came out, and I'd been looking for an opportunity to revisit it. And then when I saw that it was playing on a rooftop in the middle of Hollywood, I was like, oh, yeah, that's excellent. So my wife and I went and checked that out. And I still really like this movie. It's great. I know it's sort of became divisive around Oscar time, but I think especially with that conversation fading and Moonlight sort of taking its rightful place, I think now people will be able to judge La La Land on its own terms. And as a movie, I still just really love what Damien Chazelle did with that film. And yeah, it was pretty amazing just to, you know, watch the film, you know, a couple blocks away from a lot of the places where they shot it. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I have to see that again. I haven't seen it since it came out. I didn't rewatch it during Oscar time, but I have it on iTunes, so I'm gonna have to check that out. On Friday night, I went back to the Magic Castle. I'm not a member yet, but I got invited by a magician to go back to the castle and see some shows. So I just wanted to mention briefly that I went back there. I saw a bunch of acts, including Chef Anton, who is this guy that he's been on Fool Us, and he's more of like one of those crazy, like, they can do trick shots on a pool table kind of guys. But okay. he does like this prediction trick out of it, and it was actually kind of cool because he was videotaping himself for an audition tape for America's Got Talent next year. So if he gets in, I saw the audition.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Johnny Thompson, who is this, I mean, he is a classic magician. He has consulted for all the big magic acts, including Penn and Teller. And it was great to finally see him in person. And he does this act with just, for the most part, cups and balls. You know, an act that everybody's seen before. But he does it like four different ways, and it's incredible. I saw Michael Amar again, and he picked me. I'm not sure if he recognized me or anything. I doubt it. But he picked me to do the rubber band trick with. So I held the rubber band for him, and he gave me the rubber bands at the end of the show, which is super cool, a super cool end cap to the story last week. And I also saw John Armstrong, who's my friend. You might have seen him do the tiny plunger trick on a bunch of different shows, including Fool Us. And he is amazing. And he did his act with this guy named Bob Gerbert, who does the act as a Hollywood executive. Like kind of like a Hollywood executive that you hate, that okay. just that just wants to make crap to make money. And yeah. he does the whole thing like has the audience predict the next blockbuster that can make money, and it does like a book test with a screenplay, and it was just really good. It was a really cool act, a really good night. Seth Rogen was there with a party bus full of his friends. I don't know what they were there for, but I saw a couple shows with Seth Rogen. Not that he knew I was there. He was in full. Sometimes when you see celebrities in L.A. and you try to, even if you know them, you say like, "Hey, Seth," they can be in like the full like mode where they have the blinders up, like they don't want to be bothered by fans.
Oh yeah,
and they kind of like pretend not to hear. And I think he was in that kind of mode.
I've seen Kevin Bacon at the grocery store, and he acts like that too. You know, and I don't blame him. Like you're out in public, and yeah, you don't want to be hounded all the time.
Yeah, and I find John Armstrong introduced me to Jim Lee, the comic book artist who drew much of the comics that from my childhood, him and Rob Liefeld. And I got to geek out with him, and we follow each other on Twitter, and it was great to finally meet him. But enough of the name dropping. I want to talk about The Defenders, the Marvel TV show. Have you watched any of this yet?
No, I have not.
Are you watching any of the Marvel Netflix shows?
Not me.
Yeah, you only pick the good stuff. Right, like you.
I mean, I've heard so many mixed things about it. Like, I heard Daredevil season 2 was pretty good, but and like Jessica Jones is supposed to be pretty good, but all the other ones, it's sort of like take it or leave it. Is the gist I get from the general, the general crowds, and it's like I don't know if I want to commit, you know, however many hours, and like there's the big thing with Netflix about a lot of their shows being too long and just being padded out to hit the numbers. And I just, I'm sort of like, unless I hear good things from people that I trust, I'm not going to dive into something like
that. Well, I would definitely recommend the two seasons of Daredevil and maybe Jessica Jones. The Defenders, I'm 5 episodes in, and I got to tell you, you hit it right on the money when you said it was padded too long. It took them like 3 episodes to get to the fun part, which is where you see the heroes from these different series interact with each other. But once that happens, it's actually a lot of fun. So it takes a couple episodes to get to that point. The first 2 episodes were not so great. The villains of the season, Sigourney Weaver is the main villain, but it's kind of the Hand, which is kind of like this samurai
like the Foot
group.
Clan. Yeah.
And it's kind of uninteresting. So, but I do like the interaction. Jessica Jones, kind of sarcastic, like insulting, you know, the other members of the group. Daredevil trying to keep, you know, his secret identity amongst these other superheroes. I'm interested to see where it goes. It's gotten to a fun point. The last couple episodes have been kind of fun. I know we have a review on the site that called it disappointing. And I definitely see problems. I see cracks. but I'll report back after I see the whole series. I think it's 10 or 12 or 13 episodes, something like that. So with that review, it doesn't sound like anything you'd want to see.
No, probably not.
Of course. Last week we talked about our picks for the Joker. I just wanted to mention, because we asked people for their feedback, what listeners would like to, who they would like to see as the Joker. And I just wanted to mention a couple of the better responses. Colin Singh, I don't know, Singh, suggested Charlie Hunnam. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's Charlie Hunnam has always been one of those guys that I've found to be very bland and sort of like a boring personality. But I think if you put him into a character as manic and as interesting as the Joker, maybe that could be the thing that sort of takes him to the next level as an actor. Because I've seen him, and have you ever seen Green Street Hooligans, the movie from like 2005 that Lexi Alexander directed?
I did see it probably in 2005. I didn't even remember he was in it.
Yeah, he's like one of the main characters. Him and Elijah Wood are like the main characters in that. And that's where I first saw him. And I was like, oh, this guy's great. And then I haven't really liked him in almost anything else I've seen him in. I also haven't seen Lost City of Z yet. But yeah, I think that's definitely an interesting suggestion, because that might sort of force him to step it up, or force it at least be interesting, you know?
See, you're a bit more optimistic than me. I haven't seen Lost City of Z. I've heard great things about him in that. But everything I've seen of him, he's been just dull and the worst part of the movie for me. Yeah. So not on my list. Mike F. from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada says, quote, I think Jake Gyllenhaal could pull off with his range, transforming ability and intensity. Think about Nightcrawler. I also think that Ben Foster could trim back down. He would be amazing in the role, as he is such a great character actor. Both of those choices were on our initial wish list, which we I'm not sure if anybody knows this, but we're in a Slack channel with the whole Slash Film writing team. And when we put together like one of these lists, we throw out all these like names and we narrow it down to, I think this time it was like 14 names, but these two didn't make the cut. I think Jake Gyllenhaal just didn't make the cut, because if this is going to be a Joker origin story and he's a young Joker, Gyllenhaal is, I think, not so young.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not sure why Ben Foster didn't make the cut.
Yeah, I think he's also like surprisingly old for, you know, he always plays characters that tend to seem younger than he is. But I think he's probably not quite age appropriate either for a young Joker. But yeah, a young Ben Foster, like, I don't know, 310 to Yuma era Ben Foster would have been a cool choice.
Yeah, I know Jack Giroux was really pushing for Ben Foster. He's a huge Ben Foster fan. Let's just jump into the news. Stephen King's It, the first reactions have hit the web. You got to see it this past weekend. How is it?
It is very good. It's very, very good. So Brad Ethan Anderton on the site, his headline for the early buzz article, in which he rounds up a lot of reactions and stuff, is "A terrifying movie with heart, true to the spirit of the book." And for me, that's exactly that's a perfect explanation of what this film is. I can't get too much into it because official reviews are still embargoed for another week or two, or I guess probably just a week from now. But yeah, this movie, as somebody who's a big fan of the book, I read the book for the first time leading up to the release of the first trailer, so I could be sort of like all caught up with it. And they split the book in half. The book follows adults and kids, and the movie just follows the kids. And it was a decision that I wasn't crazy about when I first heard about it, but
yeah, because the book kind of flashes in between them, so you of get moments that like reflect upon each other, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's like some of those moments you're talking about are some of my favorite parts of the book. But having seen the film, the casting is just like spot on perfect for just about every single one of the Losers Club, and Bill Skarsgård, who plays Pennywise, is. he's so good in this movie. It's like his voice is, I'm still not sure how I feel about his voice in this film, but it is so alienating and bizarre that ultimately I think it's a perfect fit for a character that is himself alienating and bizarre and just like super weird and ancient. And yeah, he does these things with his eyes, and his there are some great jump scares in this movie, and scares that are legitimately earned too, not just jump scares left and right. But the movie is pretty long. It's like 2 hours and 14 minutes or something like that. And they build on the relationship of the kids so much that they do the work, basically. They pave the way for a lot of these scares to feel earned and legitimate. And you really get to know these kids, and their dynamic together feels like another Stephen King property, like Stand By Me. You know, the camaraderie between them and all of that stuff is like ripped straight out of the book. And it's a really, really great adaptation. They do make some changes from the book, but they definitely keep the essence of it. And I tried to watch the 1990 miniseries starring Tim Curry on TV the other night. I had never seen that as a kid.
You had never seen it? I loved it as a kid.
Yeah, and I think that's the reaction a lot of people have. As long as they see it when, you know, at a certain age, it's like terrifying for them. But watching it now, and especially like knowing that I was about to see this quote unquote real movie that is about to come up, it looks so cheap and just sort of it looks like a made for TV movie from 1990. It's super cheesy and not at all scary in the way that this movie is scary. And obviously they were like hampered by the fact that it was a primetime you know, that miniseries aired on ABC in 1990. So like they clearly couldn't do a lot of the R-rated stuff that they can do in this movie. But yeah, it's very scary. It's probably going to make Warner Brothers a ton of money, and deservedly so. It's a very good movie.
I hope so. I'm excited to see it. I haven't gotten a screening invite yet, so I'll probably have to go see it with the masses if I ever get my movie pass card. It hasn't come in the mail yet. But also in the news over the weekend, we learned that director Tobe Hooper passed away at age 74. Hooper is best known as an influential horror filmmaker. He directed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974. You know, did some other stuff, including Poltergeist. There was that whole controversy of did Steven Spielberg direct that, or did he you know, there's really not sizable answers to that mystery. DJ ruled that Tobe Hooper did, but he directed a bunch of stuff, including a miniseries adaptation of Stephen King's Salem's Lot. Did some Tales from the Crypt episodes, Amazing Stories, Masters of Horror, Freddy's Nightmares. Remember that TV show? It was horrible. And I didn't have a huge love for Tobe Hooper. I mean, I like Texas Chainsaw Massacre just fine, but I'm not a huge horror guy. Do you have a big
Yeah, I'm sort of in the same boat as you. I'm not really a huge horror guy, and I've only seen probably a handful of those movies that you mentioned, so I still need to go through and sort of familiarize myself with a lot of his catalog. But I know he was like a major, major force in the horror world, and a lot of people took that loss pretty hard. And it's easy to see why, just from, you know, Poltergeist and Texas Chainsaw. Like the guy was clearly very talented. So
if you haven't seen his films, his presence and what he brought to the horror movie genre, it was felt in many, many other films. It's sad to see another death. Another week, another death in this film world. Also in the news, last week we talked about Hellboy casting, which was a little controversial. They had changed the ethnicity of a character from, I think, Japanese to white. We have some news on that front.
Yes. So Ed Skrein, who is the guy who is cast as Major Ben Daimo, I believe is how you pronounce his name, Daimyo, in Neil Marshall's Hellboy reboot, has himself backed out of the movie. He will no longer be playing that character. He released a statement on Twitter where he basically said that he accepted the role because he wasn't aware that the character in the original comics was of mixed Asian heritage, and he just couldn't go forward with it. He says, it's clear that representing this character in a culturally accurate way holds significance for people, and that to neglect this responsibility would continue a worrying tendency to obscure ethnic minority stories and voices in the arts. I feel it's important to honor and respect that. Therefore, I've decided to step down so the role can be cast appropriately. So it's a really like...
Yeah, I'd love to clap for him right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like this kind of thing doesn't really happen that much. I mean, almost never.
Well, I asked in our Slack channel, I was like, has a whitewashing controversy ever changed the casting decision in a film?
I don't think it has. More often than not, it's really like... directors or even the actors themselves sort of doubling down on the decision when they're confronted with it in a really like defensive way. Like even Ridley Scott, you know, did this with Exodus: Gods and Kings, trying to justify it by saying like, oh, you know, we couldn't make the movie if we did it without you know, white name brand actors, essentially. But this is a really cool move on Ed Skrein's part, and he's an actor that, like, honestly, I don't really like him that much as an actor, but now, you know, seeing something like this, seeing him make this decision, definitely makes me want to take a second look at him and actually pay attention to the projects that he does moving forward, because, like I said, you just don't see this kind of thing happen, and it's very cool that he recognized the uproar that rightly came when he was cast in this role and said, you know what, I actually don't want to be a part of this, instead of just doubling down like everybody else and making excuses for it. He's clearing the way for, you know, somebody of Asian descent to actually step into this role. And that's a really awesome thing.
Yeah, it's a weird move, too, because it's not a lead role. It's like a supporting character, right?
And I think so, yeah.
And it's not like they were going to bring more people into theaters with, you know, his name, brand value.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, it's weird that they didn't just try to cast someone of Japanese heritage anyways. I don't know. It's definitely great that he did that. And it sounds like production is now looking for a Japanese actor to fill that role, which is win-win in the end.
Totally.
Also in the news, a new Star Wars comic that's coming out will give Luke Skywalker a significant connection to Rogue One. Ethan Anderton wrote the article for SlashFilm.com, but basically the gist is, and there's actually a couple cool things about this, is this new comic book, well, the Star Wars comics in general have been filling in the space between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. Not that we need that gap of time filled in, but that's what they've been doing. And so far they've really not dealt with Luke's relationship with the Rebellion. It's been more of Luke discovering his Jedi abilities and evading the Empire and stuff like that. So this one is going to deal more with his relationship with the Rebellion. And also, you know, Leia is going to have to come to terms with some devastation that hits her on a personal level as well. The writer of the comic basically reveals that, let me find the exact quote here. So we're kind of starting with a smaller story, explicitly integrating with and exposing the New Hope characters to everything that happened in Rogue One. We're going to the post-apocalyptic wasteland that was left after the Empire blew a hole in Jedha and removed one of the holiest sites there. That's great for all the characters. We're taking Leia to a planet that was shot by the Death Star. For a survivor of Alderaan, that's everything. Then Luke is searching for spirituality of Jedi, and he's taken to a big hole where the holiest site used to be. That's an enormous visual that expresses the problem that Luke is facing. What he's looking for isn't there anymore. The interesting thing here is Jedha, I think we all assumed that, like, you know, it's gone, and it is gone. The city, Jedha City, is gone. Death Star did blow it up, but according to this, I guess there is other civilizations, other settlements on this planet. And even though the settlements are small and not as holy as Jedha City, we're going to get to see them. And for Rogue One, that was one of the locations I was disappointed that we didn't get to see more of. So it's going to be interesting to see more of that. And also, the Empire took all the kyber crystals from that planet, but apparently they're going back to the planet because there's something there. So there's some kind of mystery at the core of this. And also Luke discovers the story of Jyn Erso and what we saw happened in Rogue One. The author Gillian says, though that we get people like Luke discovering everything that allowed him to get into a position to destroy the Death Star. He finds out that Jyn Erso and all the people who sacrificed their lives to give him the chance to be a hero. You can imagine that's going to hit Luke hard. So I don't know. Sounds great to me. I'm already all in on the Star Wars comics. Have you read any of the Star Wars comics?
I have not. I've read a lot about them, you know, having to write about their plot points and stuff for the site, but I have not actually like dived in and or dove in and really sort of got into that side of the world. I do love the connections, though. I think that's just a really cool thing that Lucasfilm is doing, where it's like it's not necessarily it's not necessary for everyone's understanding of the movies, the stuff that happens in these comics, but if you want to spend more time in those worlds, it's cool that they're, you know, drawing these parallels and sort of crisscrossing storylines and stuff, making explicit connections between movies that you never really thought would be referenced. I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, I think it comes down to three things for me. There's cool moments that we never got to see. Like, we never got to see Darth Vader realize that the person that blew up the Death Star was Luke Skywalker, his son. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that we get to see in the comics. And moments like those make the comics worth reading. There's a lot of fan service. You know, there's Luke Skywalker coming face to face with Boba Fett, and sand gets thrown in someone's eye so he doesn't see him, so it makes sense when he first sees him the first time. You know, BS kind of stuff like that. But also, as much as I like this is kind of cool, it does... I kind of hate how the Star Wars world is retconning everything in. Like, it's kind of weird that Luke is discovering the story of Jyn Erso, you know, months after the attack on the Death Star. Like, you'd think when he was going to the Death Star, at some point he would have been told about this group that got the plans and whatever.
Yeah.
But yes, it's cool. I highly recommend them. At least the initial Star Wars series. You can check that out. I think Marvel publishes them. You can see them on Comixology. That's where I subscribe to them. And that does it for the news. Ben, where can we find more of your work?
You can find me at slashfilm.com and on Twitter at Ben Pears.
In our feature presentation, Hui Tran Bui joins me to talk about her visit to Pixar to learn about their new film, Coco. HT, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. So this is your first time visiting Pixar. I've been there quite a bit. So not that the magic has worn off on me, because every time I go there, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. But what is it like going to Pixar Studios in Emeryville, California?
It is, it's just magical. So this is not only my first time visiting Pixar, but my first time doing a sort of trip for a film-related business trip. So this was just doubly exciting for me. And just going into Pixar Studios, and you're like entering this whole world that is built around all of their most iconic and famous films. And you go in and like, it's basically a campus, very much like a Silicon Valley type of workplace. But then you have this huge sculpture of Luxo Jr. from their first short and their title sequence as well. And there's just all these sculptures you see of a Lego sculpture of Buzz and Woody from Toy Story, a big sculpture of The Incredibles, which you get to pose next to. And the Pixar PR people were very lenient with allowing us just fanboy and fangirl about everything there. There's like, yeah, just leave them 10 minutes to take pictures and selfies and brag that they're at Pixar. And it's really cool because they have a little glass case at the front of the building that they took us in that has all of their awards. Actually, I don't think you've seen all their awards.
It's a huge glass case. It's like, I don't know how long, like 15 feet long, filled with awards.
It is a big glass case, but I don't even think that is the entirety of their collection. I'm pretty sure they were like, oh, well, let's put it at the front of the building, but let's be humble and not include everything. So it's their way of showing off, but stepping back at the same time. And it was really cool. That was the closest I've ever been to an Oscar. So I got to put my finger close to it. But yeah, it was amazing. It was magical. I went to the Pixar gift store too, which unfortunately didn't have a lot of things that I really wanted. Like, there's some cool t-shirts that I saw people who had gone there before had, and I wanted one of those, but there was a lot of just Cars 3 stuff.
Yeah, a lot of things happen to be around what the last film that they released are, but the Pixar store is usually incredible because half the stuff there is only stuff you can buy at Pixar. Yeah. Like a few years ago, I bought this it's a, I don't know how you describe it. It's a it's the Pixar logo with Luxo in the Pixar logo, and you press a button and Luxo jumps around. It's, you know, I should post a video in the show notes or something for people to see it. But it's like this toy, but it's like the most elaborate, like, thing for a studio to just produce for their gift shop. And I don't think they still have it anymore. But the stuff there is incredible. You didn't buy anything?
I bought a postcard of Buzz and Woody for one of my best friends, so I'm going to send that to her. I think it's really funny that they have a whole clothesline of John Lasseter Hawaiian shirts. So I thought that was hilarious. I had no idea that this line existed until someone who was on the junket with me was like, yeah, you should buy one of the John Lasseter Hawaiian shirts. I'm like, what? That's a thing? So
They sell them at D23 each year. And honestly, they actually sell out. And the only place you can actually get them is at that gift shop now. So I think if you bought one, you could probably sell it on eBay. But not that you would do that. Let's move on to Coco. Coco's their latest film. From director Lee Unkrich, who did Toy Story 3. And it's what do we know about Coco?
So Coco is a movie set in Mexico, set on the Day of the Dead. It actually only takes place in that one day and night. So it has a really short sort of it's mostly done in real time. And it's about this boy, Miguel, who has a passion for music and wants everything just to be a musician like his idol Ernesto de la Cruz, but his family is very adamant against music. They ban music in their household and want him to become a shoemaker. So after a series of rash decisions,
always works in getting someone, yes, getting a kid to stop. So
yeah, it's like, you know, have you not watched Footloose? But after a series of rash decisions, he ends up stuck in the land of the dead, which is open once a year during the Day of the Dead, in which all the ancestors from this town and like everywhere in Mexico cross over and are able to visit their loved ones and families who are still living. But they don't see them, but it's a sort of spiritual thing. And it's based on the actual traditions and practices that are done in Mexico on the Day of the Dead. So it was
You saw the first 30 minutes at Pixar, right?
Mm-hmm. They showed us the first 30 minutes. About the first 20 minutes of it was fully done. Like the last 10 or 15 was in sketches and not completely finished yet. And they had some stock music too, which they had not finished composing yet. But it was incredibly charming. I was smiling the entire time. I remember being a little worried going in because Coco is definitively about this Mexican heritage and about like this Mexican family. And while they had an all Latino cast, it was there were a lot of white people who are not Latino working on this film. And there's often problems like issues of cultural sensitivity when these kind of things come around. Although director Adrian Molina was brought on as co-director a little bit later on in the project. He's a Mexican American, but they watching the film and seeing the process that they described to us during the junket, they really put their all into researching the customs and the traditions of Mexico and making sure they do right by them. I do not know very closely what the Day of the Dead really encompasses, but it did feel really authentic to me while I was watching it. And even as someone who was not Mexican, I really felt this connection as a person of color, just seeing this tradition playing out on like this in this animated film for like this mainstream audience. And it struck me that the traditions I celebrate as a Vietnamese American, we have this tradition called Dzol, which is the similar memorial to our ancestors that we do on the anniversary of their deaths. We don't do like a single day for it like Mexico does, but it's incredibly similar. We have the altar. We have their favorite foods that we put up on the altar on there with the photographs. So I think that Coco, it might not have been purposefully, but it really struck a universal and authentic chord with me. And I think that it will do that for many immigrants and people of color who watch it.
Yeah, well, Disney's really good at that. And they're really good at researching, obviously, with Moana. They have that the Polynesian Culture Trust, I think it was called. And, you know, I mean, maybe your culture will be next, because Pixar, you know, they did a short film. Mm-hmm. What was that called? Something Sanjay's Super Team.
Yes, which is, Sanjay, yeah, Super Sanjay's Team.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Super Team, Moana, this. And I feel like all of those do a great job of what you're saying.
Yes.
Exposing you to that culture, but making it feel so general and so you connect with it, even if you are not of those races or of those cultures, rather.
I agree. I really appreciated that. And I didn't even go into like the content of the movie, but I won't go into spoilers. The dog, the animal sidekick, Dante, is definitely a scene stealer. He is just hilarious with his physical gags. He has this huge long tongue that's just hanging out and lolling around the entire time. Gael Garcia Bernal's character is also going to be a scene stealer. He plays this skeleton named Hector, who's kind of like this ragamuffin trickster character who Miguel befriends in The Land of the Dead and who he teams up with in order to go on this mission to find his idol, Ernesto de la Cruz, who he thinks will help him get back to the land of the living. So I won't go into any more spoilers than that. I only saw like 5 minutes of Gael Garcia Bernal's character on screen, but I completely fell in love with him. That's not just because I'm biased and I'm in love with him as an actor. So I'm very excited for this film.
And, you know, this is Pixar's first film with, like, you know, I mean, it's going to be a skeleton cast,
mm-hmm.
and it's a kids movie. What are the troubles about, you know, with bringing skeletons to life in a children's tale?
Yeah, so they talked a little bit about this during the junket. I remember watching A Nightmare Before Christmas and being terrified as a kid, not being able to watch it until recently. And they did try to sort of make a realistic depiction of skeletons at the same time as making them exhibit the emotions that a human can exhibit. And just by either their walk or their gait, or they put them in like wigs and put face paint on them to mimic the eyebrows and facial hair and everything. And they really try to put a lot of emotion into these skeletons' faces, which is hard to do. A lot of it does deal with close-ups of like these skeletons' faces. Miguel, as he stays longer in the Day of the Dead, in the Land of the Dead, does turn more into a skeleton. So you have to have that sort of like connection with him, even as he's losing like the emotion in his face. But they said that it's important that the characters themselves in the film don't exhibit any like fear of the skeletons, and that's what helps the audience not have any fear of them. So Miguel, especially as the protagonist, when he's not scared of the skeletons, then it helps ease the audience along.
You know, every time I'm at Pixar, and this shouldn't surprise me, but it does, is how much they think into every little detail that you wouldn't even think would be something that they like spend time on. But they've mm-hmm. obviously spent, you know, weeks and months on every little possible detail. And just that, you talked about in your piece, how Coco is influenced by John Wick, Spirited Away, and some Mexican history. We talked about mm-hmm. the Mexican history aspect of that. But yes. How about John Wick and Spirited Away?
So John Wick was actually kind of a throwaway thing, but I thought it was so funny that they used John Wick as a reference for the lighting in the film that I had to include it. So they talked about how the Land of the Dead is permanently in nightfall, so it's always dark, so they have to really illuminate it with all sorts of bright and intense colors, and often this ends up being very neon and very intense, very much like the color palette that we see of John Wick. So John Wick was one of the films which they referenced to create this really vibrant color palette to make it seem like it was this place that was filled with the undead, or the dead was actually so much more alive than even the Land of the Living. At some point they were even afraid that like it would make the Land of the Living seem kind of washed out just because everything was so vibrant in the Land of the Dead. So I thought, yeah, it definitely, you can see shades of John Wick in the lighting of the film, just because like there's a lot of purple, a lot of reds, blues.
I can definitely see that just from the trailers. And what mm-hmm. about, I mean, you're a big Miyazaki fan. What about Spirited
yes.
Away?
Oh, I definitely saw even the trailers, just like the Spirited Away and Studio Ghibli vibes that I saw from it. Like the story itself is very similar to Spirited Away, in which this character gets stuck in this otherworldly, literal otherworld, usually somewhere something that's populated by spirits or the dead, like Miguel is here. And it kind of leads into this sort of Alice in Wonderland type trip in which they go further and further down the rabbit hole. And Spirited Away is similar to that. Also, just the look of it, there's a lot of darkness and Spirited Away too, but it's also really illuminated by these lanterns and lights. And there's also at one point where the bathhouse that she's staying at gets surrounded by these floods of water, which is similar to what the City of the Dead. They're all like isolated with these pools of water just like surrounding them.
They mention that as an influence for that, or you're just taking it away?
I asked them, and they're like, yeah, we did reference that when we were like just starting the film, and we wanted to take away some of the spirituality of Miyazaki films and Ghibli films. So I was like, okay, yeah. I got you. and also there's actually a steampunk vibe in some of the City of the Dead, which I thought was really fascinating, which did remind me of Howl's Moving Castle as well. Yeah. And how just precarious the towers of all the houses that the people who live in the City of the Dead live in. It's like, just houses stacked on top of each other, and they just kind of become this unwieldy tower that looks very steampunky because it's all these different times and periods that these houses are from. So it was fascinating. It's a really interesting blend of just like history and modernism.
For sure. And John Lasseter is obviously a big fan of Miyazaki. He, you know, Miyazaki's visited Pixar, and Totoro was in Toy Story 3, I believe, because yes. of that relationship. So there is a relationship there. And Disney also releases all the Miyazaki films with English dubs.
Exactly. And the original Toy Story, the flying scene in which Buzz lifts Woody up, and after they get they're at the end of the film when they're trying to reach the truck.
Yeah.
That scene was influenced by the flying scene in Spirited Away, I think, or Kiki's Delivery Service. I think it was Spirited Away. I remember John Lasseter speaking about that.
I didn't even remember. I've never heard of that. Well, HT, it was great to have you on here. You have a bunch of pieces on the site from this visit, and I think we're going to have more later too, some interviews.
Yes.
Where can we find more of your work online?
You can find me at slashfilm.com. I'm on Twitter at htranbui, and I have a podcast, the Millennial Falcon Podcast, on iTunes.